So a number of weeks back, I am a little stressed. We got family coming over, big barbecue, and I have been tasked with a Costco run, and I'm a little worried we're going to have enough time to get everything done prior to the family showing up. How many have ever been in that place? So I am out on a mission. I get into that Costco parking lot. I don't see faces. I just see the stuff I need. I'm elbowing my way through the store, grab my items, and I head for checkout. I head into the checkout area, and it is jammed. So I do what everyone does. I scan for the quickest line, quickly scanning number of items in each basket. Beeline over for the winner. I get into the line, and I can feel that line just kind of pulling ahead of everyone else, and this kind of this sense of relaxation comes over me. It's like, I'm okay. I'm in the right line. I can tell I'm relaxed as I pull out my phone, start checking my emails, and reply to a text. All of a sudden, I notice we're not moving. I look up and I do kind of one of these down the line, and I notice the woman with the kids is still at the till. And instantly, I get back to nerve, put the phone back in my pocket. I don't know what I think I'm going to do about it, but I start looking over, and I'm a little bit annoyed. I'm thinking, if this is a coupon issue, I am going to be choked. So I'm watching carefully. What is the holdup here? And I can tell someone behind me is a little annoyed, too. They're kind of like, what's the problem? And someone's cracked a joke. I can hear them smirking. We're all talking about the lady at the front. She's got a couple kids, the basket. So I'm thinking, you know what? Just move her out of the way. Get her to the customer service. Let's just keep this line going. And then I notice her pulling some items out of her cart back onto the counter. And I'm going, what the heck? And I notice the cashier scanning them quickly. She pulled out about, I don't know, 6 or 7 items. I'm thinking, what? And then cashier takes her card again, swipes it through. And then I watch the cashier kind of going. Now, I know everyone's looking down the line. And it's like, in a heartbeat, we all start picking up on what's going on. I'm just like, oh no, oh no, oh no. She's pulling out more items now. Now, and I am just dying. I'm about 5 people away from her. I'm just going, oh, just run up. Here, take my card. Just, and the car goes through again. And this lady is apologizing to the cashier. She's apologizing to the next person. Her one kid is crying. And it's like the whole scene, there is this chaos all around us, but everyone that knows what's going on in this line is dying. Going, just somebody. She pulls out a bunch more and finally scans. Everything goes through. Another guy comes along and starts loading all of the stuff that she couldn't afford to buy back into a cart that she was going to ship away. And she beelines for the door. Have you ever felt embarrassed? Deep embarrassment? Shame? About something in your life, when you felt people looking at you, when you felt people perhaps talking about you when you walked into the room, maybe you've known people are thinking negative things about you, and you just sit there feeling so exposed. Every day it seems, if I look carefully, I find people in situations like that. For some, it's surrounding where they live. For some, it's the kind of vehicle they drive. For some, it's a mistake or a failure that they've made in their past, and or a past chapter of their life surfaces. For some, it's their marital status when that comes up. A financial reality. For some, it's something about their appearance that they hold some kind of shame about. I was just at another cashier the other day in a retail store, and the cashier is sitting there, and she's got these long sleeves, and I notice a little tattoo poking out from underneath her sleeve. I'm thinking, I'm just wanting to be nice. She looked like she was having one of those tough days. I said, is that a tattoo under your sleeve? She grabs her sleeve and pulls it back. She goes, yes, but I don't want to show it. I don't like it. Okay. Didn't know what to say. Shame. Painful embarrassment. And I'm not sure, but I think to some degree, I think there is common within all of us a fear that one day, whatever that area of shame that we hold, wherever that is, someone is going to come and lay it bare. Someone is going to expose, ridicule, embarrass us. Let me ask you a question this morning. How could someone help in your moment of embarrassment or shame? How could someone help you in that area that you do not want exposed at all cost? I want to talk about that this morning. Because I think this is an area that touches all of us. And the story I want to tell this morning, I think, gets at this real well. Which might surprise you when you hear about the story. Because I'll be honest with you, growing up, I didn't see the connection to where I'm going this morning. But in order to tell the story, because it happens in another time, era, chapter of world history that is hard for us to relate to, I just want you to imagine for a second that you, working for a large organization, have been tasked with planning the retirement party for the founder of this company. Well-respected and liked man who you've worked for many years, someone says, would you spearhead the party? And in the process, industry peers, high-profile clients have been invited. They're flying in from out of town. The venue is booked and beautiful. On the day of, you have different employees running to the airport to pick up and chauffeur in these clients. I mean, this thing is big. The tables are beautifully decorated with amazing ornaments. The band is working out their thing. The lighting is perfect. This ballroom is absolutely amazing. Problem is, you're noticing the catering department is somehow not showed up yet. And so you have someone, you task them, you say, make the call. They should be here. And so you get wrapped up in all this thing, and half an hour before, someone comes back to you and says, I can't get through to them. You're going, no. And you're flipping back to you, no, we paid the deposits. No. They were supposed to be here about an hour. So now you're climbing on the phone. Now guests are starting to show up. The band's starting to play. You got people arriving in the doors. You got this beautiful environment. And finally, you get through to someone in that catering company that says, there's been a grave problem. We thought you were this other group. The food has all been delivered over there. We've planned all this. We got no food coming. And the founder's coming over going, thank you, this is so great. Go to the story. Jesus is hanging out with his closest buddies, his disciples, at a wedding. and they're having a good time. I can imagine the music playing. They're probably reclining on the floor in the corner, and it's a party. People are dancing, having a great time. And Jesus' mother comes over to where Jesus is, and she looks really concerned. She says, "Jesus, they're almost all out of wine." Now, growing up with this story, I was like, okay, so her table is out of wine. Just go and grab a couple bottles from the other tables and bring it over. Someone's drinking a little much, whatever. I'm looking at him going, okay. What you don't realize when you read the story is that this wedding took place in Cana, a little village in Galilee in northern Israel. A rural village, a village full of peasants, if you will. Peasants lived a very meager life, very simple. They weren't vegetarians, but their diets were predominantly vegetarian. Nuts, olives, vegetables. Oh, they loved meat, but you know what? They had these family animals they would raise, and those things would only be eaten for most special occasions. This probably the most special occasion in all of first century Palestine was the wedding. This was the biggie. Nothing greater than the wedding in their world. When a wedding was about to happen, family and friends, neighbors stopped everything. They came from far and wide, giving up their own income to come and celebrate with the families involved. Weddings were no simple Saturday afternoon affair like they are here. You get in, get out, be home in time to watch the news that night. No. No, these things traditionally would last up to 7 days. When people showed up, they were there for the duration. Oh, there was going to be a party. People didn't have to worry about designated drivers. They were staying the night and night and night. So here they are, and the party is just getting rolling. People are just having a good time now. And Jesus' mother comes up to him and says, "They're almost out of wine." Scholars suggest in this culture, running out of wine for so many reasons was something you never allowed to happen. Some speculate it might have been an issue of finances. The family couldn't afford to make enough or to buy enough. Lots of speculations over why. But all of them agree. When news was dropping within that close circle at the wedding that they were running out, this was massive. So Jesus' mom is watching. I don't know if she's just kind of hearing some of the back conversations. She comes over to Jesus and says, "They are almost out of wine." And Jesus kind of looking at her going, is this our problem? And when you read the story, it's kind of like, I think it is. Do something. She turns to these servants and says, "Do whatever he tells you to do." So Jesus discreetly moves into action. He calls over the servants. He says, "You see those big urns over there?" Which had nothing to do with the wedding. These urns holding 20 to 30 gallons, typically used for religious purposes. Kind of a purity ritual Jews did. He says, "See those over there? Fill them up with water." They don't ask questions. They beeline for the water. They get these things filled up to the brim. Jesus says, "Okay, tell you what. Take this pitcher. Fill it up with some of that water. And then head over to the master of ceremonies over there and pour it into a wine glass for him, will you? Let him taste it." you got to know those servants are kind of going, what are we doing here? Okay. So sure enough, they fill it up, fill up the pitchers, they come over, and here's the master of ceremony who has probably just gone over to the bride and groom going, okay, guests are starting to ask about the wine. What do you want me to say? So these servants come up and they start pouring the water. These weren't really built well for pouring. Master of ceremony is going, what's going on here? They said, you're supposed to taste it. Mmm. Tasty. This guy goes, where'd you get this? Servants point over to six big urns. We got them from over there. He takes another drink. He walks over to the bride and the groom. They're panicking. They see him coming and they're going, oh no. You can imagine the fear of shame and embarrassment that's about to happen when they break it to the entire crowd. And the master of ceremony comes up. He reaches over them and he says, I gotta hand it to you guys. You are amazing. They're going, huh? He says, you know, I've been to 100 of these weddings. And you know what they do? They start off with the beautiful Amaronis right at the start. Everyone has a couple drinks. All of a sudden, everyone's feeling good. And then they bring out the box wine right at the end, man. They just start loading them up with the cheap stuff. Not you. Here, everyone is just starting to feel good. And you bring out the best. That bride and groom, I can see just being stunned. The bridal family sitting there, they're all panicking. And they're going, what is going on? And all of a sudden, the guy's going, you not only brought in little, you brought in 180 gallons of the finest wine. That is the most unbelievable treat. The wedding party are all sitting there going, what went on here? The story reads that Jesus wasn't sitting there going, that's how I grew up with that story. Jesus kind of comes in and says, all right, guys, everyone's panicked? Okay, hey, tell you what. Boom. No. Jesus is in the back corner going, hey, take it to him. Show him this. And there in the midst of this, what could have been one of the most embarrassing, scholars say shameful experiences for the family, a miracle happens. And that family turns from zeros to heroes. And there's Jesus in the back corner with his mom and a couple servants going, what adds even more to the story is to think about what this story meant to the early Christians who would have been listening to this at the time when this story was being read. As Vince explained last week, the Jews of Jesus' day They were an oppressed, enslaved people under the Romans. Life, for the most part, was harsh and unfair. Every day, cruel injustices were experienced. Jews would have almost become numb from dealing with all the abuse they handled on a daily basis under the Romans. For many generations, they waited and waited, believing that God would one day send a character, someone who would turn their dark times into beautiful times again. Vince shared last week that these early Christians believed Jesus was actually that character, that man who was sent to usher God back into the world again. Bringing the new reign of God that would change their physical reality, restoring the world to the way that God had originally envisioned for it. They believed Jesus was doing this. Now here's the author of John. You have to understand, when you read the Bible, it's not all in real time. The author of the book of John is penning this 60 years after Jesus has come and gone. 60 years later, it has not gone better. Things have gone drastically worse. At the time that this story is being penned and put into the book called John, they estimate over 1 million Jews have been slaughtered. Their temple has been torn down by the Romans. This is amazing. The temple where they believed God dwelled, gone, rubble. Jews are in the worst place imaginable. And John is putting together these stories, and he chooses this story of Jesus turning water into wine as the first story he wants to tell to his listeners. He's going, "I'm going to tell you about this man named Jesus." And what he did was amazing. What he started was amazing. And the first story I want to tell you is about this miracle, turning water into wine. I used to always think the emphasis, and to be honest, growing up in the church, the emphasis was on this process. This. Whoa! Jesus, yeah! Now, looking back into this thing, I don't believe the emphasis was on this miracle anymore. I don't think that was the big deal to the early listeners. As much as it was the impact of what this all meant to that wedding family who was about to be disgraced. I think the early listeners of the story would have identified strongly with the shame and the embarrassment. All they had to hear was, "They're running out of wine." And they would have felt it. I bet as this story was told, they would have been reminded in their own lives of times when they were embarrassed or felt shame. And to hear of the way that Jesus quietly, discreetly covered the family, rescuing them from shame and embarrassment, would have spoke so loudly. I think John was saying to these early listeners, in this new reign of God, Jesus didn't want people feeling embarrassed. He didn't want them cowering in shame. Could it be this story served as a challenge to those early followers to, in their own way, do the same thing for others? I grew up in a fairly traditional evangelical Christian family. A family of high-profile spiritual leaders and pastors. I don't know what it's like to not be raised in church, been in it all my life. My family on both sides, heavily churched. It was one of those straight-laced kind of families. When I was 5, in the midst of this squeaky clean Christian family, my parents' marriage was in trouble. My dad ended up leaving. And in case life wasn't difficult enough for my mom, she was there left raising three kids on her own, the youngest one just barely born. But she was too embarrassed to tell the family about the separation. Most of the family lived outside of Calgary. So she managed to keep it a secret. This is a story I just heard just recently. At a family reunion, we started talking. Here she is trying to raise the three of us, and the family doesn't know that her and dad are split. What blew me away is she kept the secret for 5 months. Shame. Embarrassment. Worried about what people are going to say or think when they find out. Every time the phone would ring and it would be a family member on the other end, my mom would, she said she'd recoil. Guarding every word that she would say out of fear for them figuring things out. Her mom, my grandma, would call. She said, I could tell rumors were starting to get around in the family, just suspicion. And she said, my grandma would ask her, they'd talk about everything, and then right at the end she'd say, everything is okay, right, Bev? And my mom just so worried about the judgment that would be brought on the family. She'd say, no, Mom, everything's fine. Everything's fine. She didn't want to break her mom's heart. But she said one day her brother called. Her brother is a pastor. And in mom's mind, he was the last one that she wanted to know. But she said, I must have just been at this breaking point where the pressure was so built up so much inside of her. And her brother started asking questions. My mom started getting flustered and didn't know how to answer some of the questions. And finally she just blurts out, Gary's gone. And Clint says, what do you mean? Like he's gone for the weekend? What do you mean he's gone? Is he on business? Or she said, no, he's gone and he likely won't be coming back. She said, she was just bawling. In that moment, she's expecting the whole thing to start. What? Are you kidding? You know, she had all these pictures in her mind of what was about to be said. All I remember him saying is, so what? And she said in her mind, it wasn't computing. She's like, no, Clint, you don't understand. I'm talking divorce. He says, so what? And she's like, you don't understand. You know, and she's just like, but she said every time he said that, so what? It was like this warm blanket got wrapped over her in a moment where she was just so, felt so exposed. He just kept on saying, it's okay. So what? So what? We're going to make this. So it's just like medicine. Expecting the words of shame and embarrassment and the judgment to just be driven in. She said they never came. Over the coming months, sadly, Mom did experience shame and judgment from others. Sadly, most of it from within the church. But Clint, she said, was like this warm blanket. She hung on to every word he said. I don't know how much later She remembers Clint being at this family function, and she said she hated family functions because there's always a few of them you could feel were looking at her weird and didn't know what to say, were awkward. She remembers Clint coming up and sliding some money into her pocket or into her purse or jacket and just whispered in her ear, he says, you're going to need this. They're in central Alberta. About a 3-hour drive back to Calgary, Mom said she bawled the whole way home. That act of quietly, discreetly covering her shame, saying, I got your back. Can't help but wonder if this is what John was trying to get at when he started off with this story. Turning water into wine. Could it be the kind of loving acts that Jesus was talking about? When he said, one day the master is going to look a bunch of people in the eye. He's going to say, you over there and you over there. And he's going to look at this group of people and he says, I was hungry and you fed me. I was naked and you clothed me. And they're going, what? And he says, when you did it to her, that was me. You were doing that for me. Now, I doubt any one of us, perhaps, will be expected to do anything like this. I hope not. I don't have that in my tool belt. I'd love to be able to turn some water into wine. It hasn't worked so far. Maybe a few late night liquor store runs. I can do that. I don't know how many of us will ever end up visiting someone in prison, or how many will actually be needed to give clothing to someone who is naked. But I can tell you right now that there are people in your life who are living in shame, who are living fearful of being exposed. I can look you in the eye and say, I promise you, there is someone in your life right now who is covering and worried. If you have ears to hear, if you have eyes to see, you will have an opportunity, I promise you. A divinely guided opportunity, perhaps even this week, to cover. To cover their shame and embarrassment. To restore their dignity where they are right now. To hold their head up high and say, shh, shh. You don't listen to anything that they say. Look at me. You are beautiful. I've watched this happen throughout this community again and again. I'm telling you, it kills me. I've watched some of you take someone by the hand and walk them into 12-step programs. No one knew. There's that person broken. You're going, hey, you're okay. Come here. Come with me. We're going together. I watch people slip money. I've watched people run over and babysit kids while that couple can spend needed time to repair something that's broken. I've watched people clean houses for people who couldn't. I've watched people as they've listened. I've listened as people have defended and stood up for someone who's failed, warding off any judgment, saying, you back off, because we've all been there. Shut up and quit talking about this. This person doesn't need this right now. This person needs your help, not your judgment. Now back off. I've watched that. I've watched friends cover four, drive their friends. Watch this with one of my ball hockey buddies. I didn't even know it. Lost his license a little while back. Everyone was offering to give him a ride home. I was clued right out, going, gosh, what are you, some kind of king? Everyone's offering you a ride home? No one ever. And there's guys looking at me going, okay, sorry. I watched the most beautiful acts of covering happening all over the place. And let me tell you something, nothing could be more spiritual than being able to cover someone's shame. Here's the thing about it, though. You have to look real closely, because shame is insidiously quiet. No one rarely comes out and says, oh, I'm feeling really bad about something. No. No, often they've got prickly guards up. They want to keep that. I don't know about you, but I do. I carry shame in areas of my life. I don't want you even knowing I'm carrying that shame. I keep it way back here. You got to look carefully for it. Because that shame makes us shrink away. It makes us avoid friends and family, even for months if necessary. You need empathy to spot it. And some of you are unbelievable at this. You sniff it out. You're watching. You see it. And then you quietly move in. And that person's... it's amazing watching some of you who are good at this so discreetly. Oh, I love it. Love it. If you tune to others' lives, if you listen carefully, watch the body language, you can spot people's nakedness, their shame, their need. It's at that point you have to quietly, discreetly move in. Now listen to me. We just did a big campaign that had people inspiring others by telling their water carrier stories. 500 stories came out about different ways people took water to their world. Listen to me this morning. These water carrying acts of covering people's shames must never, ever be talked about. Listen carefully to me. I will celebrate when we share stories and inspiring, but when you cover someone's shame, you must sit at the back of the wedding hall and you can grin and you can be excited about the impact of it. But you must not let on what's just gone down. That is powerful water carrying when it comes to this area of shame. How many are tracking with me this morning? You have an opportunity, if you watch for it this week. It might be just looking into someone who you know is just beaten up and looking at them and speaking words of beautiful words of belief in that person. It might be a phone call that just says, I am proud to be your friend. It might be a quiet, discreet act of, I don't know what it'll look like, but if you look for it, the water carrying opportunities to cover people's shame, you start looking, they are everywhere. Would you be willing this week to do that? I hope so. Let's pray. God, for this community, I ask you will show us how to be agents of covering. May God, in our own ways, we turn water into wine this week. And change someone's life, lifting their heads, raising their level of dignity, and changing their lives. Show me, open my eyes to see. In your name I pray. Amen. Amen.